You asked Mr. Ramaphosa to sit down first. I'm standing.
Now I warn you.
I need to put on my big girl panties and keep going.
You can't have two speakers standing at the same time.
Security services of the Republic of South Africa, you may intervene.
There's been several attempts on my life.
Lower that hand.
It's not alarmed.
The president is accused of serious crimes.
In order to pursue the greater good, you have to enable some people to eat a little bit.
Corrupt people do not eat alone. They have a spider web.
I now suspend the proceedings. I now suspend the proceedings. I have warned you.
Hello, this is the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we unpack the big political stories of the moment. I'm Mike Siluma. It will be the biggest political event on our national calendar, keenly anticipated for the impact it is likely to have on all of us and the future of our country. It is, of course, the national election set to take place on May the 29th. As the election race hots up, we thought we should cut through the noise and look at the election process and its significance this time around. For our conversation, we're joined by Ibrahim Fakir, who is an election analyst at the Electoral Institute, AISA. Welcome to the podcast, Ibrahim.
Thanks very much, Mike. Nice to chat to you again.
Now, you know, a lot of things have been said about this election to say it's the biggest thing that's ever happened in our political history. It's going to be a game changer. It's like everyone is anticipating the outcomes of the election. How different is it, would you say, from the previous elections, mainly in terms of how it's constituted, what our ballot paper is going to look like, that kind of thing, the number of candidates, etc.?
So everyone's anticipating this election, except, of course, it would appear voters. Simply because I'm not sure what the turnout's going to be like, Mike. And I think that's one significant feature that we should start with. So, you know, going into this election, ordinarily you think that elections are a moment at which societal renewal can occur. You can change political parties in government. You can re-give mandate to a party in government, a party in power to continue exercising authority. And one of the big things about this election is that we go into this election with the lowest levels of trust amongst political parties, both the governing.
Amongst them.
Yeah, all governing and opposition. Second feature is low levels of trust in public institutions. And that's really worrying. Third feature is, as I've alluded to, the question of turnout. And we don't know whether turnout will spike or whether it will decline further than it has declined between 2014 and 2019, mm-hmm. where in 2019 we went down to about a 65% turnout, right? And that's of registered voters, not of those who are eligible to vote, who are over 18, who ordinarily should vote but simply haven't registered. And there's a large number of those. So turnout's a key. Mm-hmm. Fourth major feature, and this is to the heart of your question, because the Constitutional Court decided that the electoral system as we had it until 2019 does not accommodate independent candidates. It does flies in the face of Section 19 of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It does not allow an individual the free association not to associate with a political party, and that used to preclude them from standing for election. So now they can stand for election. But it's almost like you trying to fit in a square peg in a round hole and make it fit, flush, when in fact you can't. So what we've done, uncannily, is retain the large elements of the pure proportional representation system and slapped onto it the opportunity for independents to participate. So that's a major difference. With the independents participating, it means that the system has changed somewhat. So it is both the same system that we had, a proportional representation system, with a mixed of what you would call a constituency system, but unlike the local government election, where we do have a relatively pure mix, this mix is saying for 200 national MPs, the whole country is a constituency. So only political parties will contest those seats for 200 seats mm-hmm. across the country. 200 other seats are going to be distributed across each of the provinces. Depending on their population size, they will be allocated at the national level in the National Assembly. Let's say Gauteng, which has the largest population size, largest number of registered voters and so on. Let's just say hypothetically, and the numbers are out, they are gazetted. Gauteng will be allocated something like 80 seats, for example. KZN,
of the 200.
Of the 200. So you got 120 left. So let's say KZN, second largest province, gets allocated 70 seats, hypothetically. So now of that, how many are left? So you had 120 left because 80 are gone to Gauteng, 70 went to KZN, so you now got 50 left. And then that will be distributed across the other provinces, right? So those are just hypothetical numbers. Each province will represent a constituency. So, and the words will be used interchangeably. Region, province, constituency. So political parties will contest with independents, individuals who want to stand on their own. They can align to a party afterwards, whatever, but they will be standing in their own name, but they'll be competing against political parties, mm-hmm. and their candidates will be on their party list. So you will be electing those latter 200 at the national level from each province, or the number of seats available for contestation in that province is determined by the Gazette, and that's been out. It will range between, I think, 80-something for Gauteng and probably 10 or 15 for a province like the Northern Cape. So that's a significant difference. In terms of the number of ballots you get, you still retain provincial legislatures where independents can contest for a provincial legislature, right? Mm-hmm. So you're now going to get a ballot to choose the party, only a party, for one of the 200 seats in the National Assembly.
The initial 200.
All right. Mm-hmm. Then you will get a second ballot to choose the national representative to go from your province or your region. That's your second ballot. And from there, you can choose either a political party or an independent, an individual. And the third ballot you will get is to choose a party or an individual to sit in your provincial legislature. So, for example, the Northwest Provincial Legislature or Limpopo Provincial Legislature. That will be your third ballot. So there's going to be three ballots this time around.
Mm-hmm. And on the other ballot, so it will just be the parties and the independents on the same?
On the same ballot. Mm-hmm. That's for 200 of the seats, yes, nationally, and for the provincial legislature, if any independents are contesting for a seat in that provincial legislature. Mm-hmm. But the others will all, the first ballot will be exclusively political parties, 200 seats that will be chosen on a pure proportional representation basis. Then the calculations will be made on the basis of a formula, which will be calculated as follows. The total number of votes which are cast divided by the number of seats available. That will, and roughly, you know, plus one, and that gives you the quotient of the votes required. It will be divided obviously by the number of valid votes cast. That will give you the quota of the number of votes required to hold a seat. Mm-hmm. So all the independents which have got the number of votes above or equivalent to that quota will be allocated the seats. Then a second formula will be worked out to distribute the seats to the political parties. Because you have already allocated seats to the independents, those seats will be subtracted, so the total number of seats now become available are less. The total number of ballots cast will be used again as the divider. Mm-hmm. And then a new formula is made, and the distribution for all parties which have got above that quota per number of seats, that allocation will happen then. So there'll be multiple rounds of allocations, mm-hmm. effectively.
Yeah. And this happens where? Who does this? Who makes the calculation? Is it the IEC?
It's the IEC. No, it's the IEC. Mm-hmm. The IEC does the calculations. traditionally and typically the votes are counted at each voting station. And then they tabulated and then they consolidated per province and then sent further up nationally. And then, of course, the calculations and recalculations happen. And there's a fairly elaborate oversight system that is used. And that includes everything from party agents who are able to watch the count, observers who can watch the count. There's civil society organizations might decide to do their own vote tabulations to correspond and co-correspond to see more or less that things check out.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, you know, there's been a lot of talk about lists. You know, if I'm not in a political party and I'm not a political animal, but I want to understand the, you know, the voting topography, if you like, you know, where do these lists come from and what are they?
The lists are lists made up by political parties, by their members, their branches, depending on what your internal system for selection in your political party is, they will have thrown up the lists. And they, some parties like the ANC, for example, would have a list conference. A party like the DA, I believe they have a combination of these list meetings with interviews for people who want to be on the list. But it is an internal process that is internal to the political party. Members of that political party would obviously have a say in the decision depending on what their processes prescribe and what their constitutions say, how they're going to select these candidates. Others might have other routines of doing so. They might handpick them, but that's a private decision made by the political parties themselves. As a member of the public, you have the option, once the lists are published, to go through them and raise an objection. Other political parties can raise an objection.
Because what kind of objection, for example?
You know, so the kind of objections you can raise are, A, the constitutional legal exclusions of people who are unrehabilitated insolvents, people who have been given imprisonment without the option of a fine. So the constitutional prescription of all those who are not eligible or not entitled to hold public office, number one. Number two, you could raise objections on the basis that this person or some person appears on more than one list. So a person who decides they are on the list of the ANC, the DA, the EFF, and some other random party. With no disrespect to other parties. But so you can't appear on more than one list. Then you got to nominate and choose which one you want to be on or not at all. Or you can be a person who's not a citizen, who's not a fictitious person, for example, where the ID number does not check out and so on. And so for all of the reasons that the legislation says a person is precluded from holding office at the basis on which you can object. And in addition, if a person appears on more than one party list, then you can raise an objection. I mean, you can go raise a complaint for anyone you don't like. That doesn't mean that the complaint would have merit. So you have a right to go raise the complaint.
And it'll be investigated.
It'll have to be
into, at least.
It has to be. That by law is the requirement. And a determination then has to be made by the IEC. Sometimes, I mean, it hasn't happened too often, but there can be instances where that person can go to court and say, this decision was irregular, and so on. By the way, you can have the same inspection for the voter's roll. And political parties often do that, which is how you pick up discrepancies of people who are not, meant to be on the voter's roll, but and people who are meant to be on the voter's roll, but are not.
Okay, now this takes us into the question I was going to ask you much, much later, you know. One of the controversies has been that, you know, for example, the DA, you know, caused a whole storm. A political storm the other day, you know, when they rode off to foreign missions and and the American Secretary of State to say, you know, can they keep an eye, you know, on this election because there's a risk of it being stolen. The MK party have said if they don't get this, that or the other, if they don't win, if that happens, they're not going to accept the, because implying basically that there's a possibility of manipulation or the election being stolen. Now, you were talking earlier about what one can call some of the checks and balances. Now, how possible, in your view, you know, is it for someone to just steal the election?
In this system, Mike, it's easy and it's hard. It's both easy and it's hard. And I mean, and that's a major contradiction. There's so many safety features built into the process of voting that I think it would be hard to do so, save for stuffed ballot boxes and stuffed pre-marked ballots hidden away somewhere, short of an electoral official overcounting or undercounting, as the case might be. Those are all the ways in which you can do it. Because our system is a pure proportional representation system. Of course, the provinces are going to count as a constituency this time around. We don't have the problem that they have in other jurisdictions called gerrymandering, where you play around with the boundaries and your vote stack. Once where you know voters of a particular stripe are in this place, let's shift the border a little bit so we put them on this side. We balance out the influence of the other voters and that kind of thing. So the gerrymandering is not a big thing here, right? But stuffing ballot boxes could be, pre-marked ballot boxes could be, under and overcounting could be, irregularities from electoral officials can be. So there's human error. So that's the one portion where it's corrupt, unethical, fiddling behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The other could be mere instances of error.
Mm-hmm.
A mistake. It happens. And where you're talking, the order of something like, let's roughly maybe 22,000, 23,000 voting stations.
Mm-hmm.
Each voting station, minimum staff of, let's say, let's be modest, but I can say three.
Mm-hmm.
Chief electoral officer, deputy for that station, and maybe one queue marshal or something else. There's many more.
Mm-hmm.
And one person to check the register. Let's just say four. Four times 22,000? You're talking 100,000 something odd people, right? Mm-hmm. Managing an election. Inevitably, something can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
An administrative error can happen. No election can be perfectly administratively run. Impossible.
Mm.
Doesn't happen anywhere around the world.
Okay.
So administrative errors can keep in. That's the creeping. That's the second category. Administrative errors or evil, malevolent, fiddling behavior of people who have bad intentions. The third is incompetence. Poorly trained people who don't know how to interpret regulations, make mistakes, and mistakes are not error, human error. These are just mistakes arising out of the fact you just don't know how the system works.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what the regulations are. Mm-hmm. You don't know, you don't use discretion in making decisions about sticky situations that mm-hmm. might arise. So that's the fourth category. Now, for each of these, remember there are things called multi-party, or I think they'll now call them political liaison committees, because it's not just parties only, but independents. Mm-hmm. And you have a right in that liaison committee to bring up all kinds of issues around the regulations, around administrative process, around how things are going to be managed, and so on. So first port of call, mm-hmm. multi-party liaison committees.
That's starting before the election.
They happen, I think, years before an election. They happen probably once, twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
Closer to an election, they start happening fairly often. And I think in the sort of 2-3 months leading up to the election, they happen kind of probably every week, every second week. So they're pretty frequent and regular.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first. Second is the IEC sets up these conflict management panels where you can start taking things. Third is you would have election observers who are entitled to watch the process. And you spoke about the DA's letter.
Mm-hmm.
What confounded me about the DA's letter is you are asking a country which has its own massive irregularities and doesn't really have observers to come and observe an election. But most curiously, South Africa has had election observers from across the board, whether international, intercontinental, continental.
Yeah, as the IEC was saying, you know, that they've never had a problem with
election observers.
Yeah, yeah.
No. And in addition to that, you have domestic civil society based, religious based, other, you know, observers who are around and they watch the process, relatively keenly. And then you have party agents. Every political party is entitled to have an agent to sit and watch the process in a voting station, including and up to the actual count.
Mm-hmm.
And there are results slips that they've got to sign and countersign. Now, if they're not there, you know, the process can't be held up because a party agent was not around to sign the slip off.
Mm.
And often you find that objections which have happened where party agents have not been present. In some cases, they've happened when they are present. But by and large, they happen when they're not present. Now, it's a lot of voting stations.
So that sounds like it's not just an IEC undertaking, even though they are running the election. It sounds to me, from what you're explaining, like a more cooperative thing, that it's transparent. You know, anybody, you know, any of the interested parties can observe all the way from the voting station.
Yeah, but you can't wake up 7 o'clock on the day of the election, Mike, and then you haven't said you're part of a mission and they haven't got you any accreditation. You decide suddenly that me and Mike, I'm an observer, I'm going in. So you got to satisfy the requirements which I established before.
Yeah.
Just a word on that. You know, there's a difference between election observers and election monitors. Monitors are generally people who undergo some fairly rigorous training and they are vetted, not just accredited. And subject to being vetted, you then have the right to intervene in processes where there might be electoral violence or major irregularities and so on. And the scope for intervention is not very wide.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you can't intervene anywhere in the process. It's proscribed by law. But we don't have we had monitors in 1994 because of the nature of the election and so on. Now, maybe the DA is asking for monitors now. I don't know. But if they're asking for observers, it's asking for something that has already been there. So I'm not surprised that people put a political spin on that. And perhaps they might consider that it may have been ill-advised to ask something that is already there or to say that we're warning that this is going to happen. But unfortunately, this is the reality of what political parties do. They try to undermine the election manager and try and find a scapegoat and say,
this is before the election, you know. So,
well, they might be doing it to preempt poor performance. I can suddenly find a person who I can start blaming, and you can't start building momentum
I told you so.
Told you these guys are not going to do this thing properly. Now, I mean, they're not the only one. MK Party is doing pretty much the same. And the public must know. The MK Party doesn't call the shots. There's a legal, legislated, regulated, constitutional framework within which this can happen. If you don't satisfy the requirements, you don't satisfy the requirements. You know, you can't now at this stage, Mike, I know you'd love to be an MP.
Yeah, indeed. But, or higher.
I mean, even if you want to be a minister, but you can only be a minister. Well, president has the opportunity to appoint two people or three people outside of members of parliament to be ministers. But to be an MP, you can be as an independent. But right now it's too late. The date's closed. You haven't registered. And you haven't met the requirements.
But what are the implications of those kinds of allegations, you know, about, you know, that we need more observers or we need more monitors or whatever it is that the DA was wanting, or from the, you know, MK Party saying, you know, implying basically that, you know, there's a possibility they're going to be robbed in this whole thing, that they're going to be denied a majority victory or something.
I'm surprised some of the key actors in the MK Party didn't think this of the IEC when they were leaders of another party. But be that as it may, the consistent denigration of the IEC is quite worrying. And this is not to say that there have not been errors.
Yeah.
There have been errors. There have been administrative issues. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, an official leaked party lists and lists of signatures that they should not have. Mm-hmm. It was not yet for public consumption. It was still an internal process. They very quickly discipline that person.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying the IEC is fantastic and brilliant, which they are. They have made mistakes. There have been increased number of complaints. There's been increased number of objections. There's been increased number of court cases even, of issues going to the court. There's increased number of disputes which are declared. But many of those have been satisfactorily resolved. But systematically, Mike, you must look at the trajectory of how parties have been blaming the IEC. So it used to start off when you had a slightly less complicated system where they said, no, the IEC is not providing equitable broadcast airtime. It's not the IEC's problem. Mm-hmm. That's the ICASA's problem.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we never had regulation of private funding.
Yeah.
And parties which didn't get money from private sources would say, it's the IEC. They're not letting us get money. And now they must regulate.
Mm.
Then you had public funding, and the public funding formula was determined by Parliament. The political parties in Parliament decided it, not the IEC. Mm. Yet they would blame the IEC because we didn't get enough public funding. So systematically it started there. Then it started becoming about elevating minor administrative problems into becoming a big, you know, making mountains out of molehills. Mm. And systematically what has done is that in the public eye eroded the credibility of the IEC, and the contagion effect of the decline of trust in public institutions emerging out of state capture and corruption, poor performance of government at local level and so on. All of that has a contagion effect on the IEC and has infected the reputation of the IEC. So before, the IEC enjoyed very high levels of credibility in many of public opinion surveys, a very stellar reputation, even internationally. And that has been declining. And when that happens, trust in the institution goes low. The public mind thinks that any spurious allegation must have merit because...
No smoke without fire kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm. And it's slightly unfair. That's not to say that there aren't issues. And I think the issues now will be compounded. But the compounding of the issues are fundamentally the fault of the political parties. The IEC is not completely innocent, particularly in making... bigger awareness about what the system is, about being honest about this new system, about the count and so on. But the devising of the system was left to Parliament. They delayed this extremely long. They missed two deadlines that were imposed by the Constitutional Court to come up with the system. Mm. Then the administrative arrangements that have to be made to accommodate the new system, the oversight systems that need to be put in place to accommodate the new system, those are going to be faced with teething problems. But and likely the IEC will make a few mistakes. People will blame the IEC, but at the heart, it's the political parties who have done so.
Yeah.
They fiddle the system. They fiddled the delays to such an extent that we are now left with scrambling with regulations.
Now, say we're now at the end of the elections, the counting is done. There's no clear winner, as in any of the parties having a majority of the thing.
Okay. 50%
plus one. 50% plus one. And then we're supposed to go, obviously, into the much talked about coalition arrangement. Who then forms the coalition? Do we have a government at that point, or don't we?
No, we don't. And remember, the Constitution says that the old administration stays in place, but for a brief period only. And at that time, we have no government. Effectively, government has to be formed. And the president has to be elected within a specified number of days, which is prescribed by the Constitution.
Yeah.
Some people say that period is going to prove a little bit short should there be the need for coalitions, because you are going to hastily come together to talk about this thing. So it can become quite hoary and quite complex. And I use the word hoary advisedly. Hoary as in prickly, not hoary as in, you know, although that might apply in this, it might apply in this case too, given the political prostitution that might start to occur. The coalition negotiations are entirely a private matter amongst political parties. We have not regulated this in any sense. And I think it's right for a liberal political dispensation like ours to leave it to political parties. But we do need some regulation. And what those regulations are, you know, there was a whole symposium which was convened by the Deputy President's office, and they came up with proposals like introducing thresholds or letting the party with the largest share of votes, even if they don't have the majority, be the first to form a government, or distribute portfolios proportionately. There's any number of these kind of proposals you can entertain.
Mm.
But as things stand at the moment, there's nothing. So it's a private negotiation between different parties who want to come together. And if you come up with the numbers, hey, you go for it.
If they don't agree?
If they don't
can't find each other?
If they can't find each other, well, then you have a prolonged crisis until they do. I mean, the bind is that you have to elect the president within, and the National Assembly has to be constituted within a certain number of days.
After the election.
Yeah. So the National Assembly will be constituted on the basis of the numbers, and the proportions that the parties and the independents get. But if they can't decide on who the president is going to be, that's going to be hard. And the public does not elect the president. The president is elected by the National Assembly. So we have an indirectly elected president.
Mm. But just talking about electing the president, you know, could an independent become president?
Hypothetically, if enough of the members of parliament, if 201 members of parliament decide that this independent should be the person, theoretically, hypothetically, that is possible because they are a member of parliament.
Yeah, but they have to be in parliament.
They have to be in parliament. Yeah. You can't not be a member of parliament to be elected as the president.
Yeah.
We don't directly elect an individual to be the president.
Now, let's go to the other element, you know, before we wrap up of the election season, as it were, you know, the opinion polls. How important are they? What use are they actually in our political system?
Listen,
are they just for entertainment? Are they for, well, what are they there for?
Listen, if they were that fantastic and accurate, let's just dispense with the cost and the nightmare and the administrative burden. And elections are expensive. Let's just do away with it and run a couple opinion polls, triangulate them. And if they were so accurate, then, well, that should be it. We dispense with the cost of doing all the other things. So, but they're not. Now, to the extent that they might get it right, some of them, if at all, I think it's more a matter of fluke than reliable indicator.
But they say they are scientific.
That's not to say, well, yeah, they're scientific in a marketing sense. And perhaps this might explain it. I think we must differentiate the opinion polls from general social science surveys, which measure sort of public attitudes, public opinions about certain things, especially with public institutions and so on, right? The thing about opinion polls in relation to elections specifically, especially in a country like this, you could well have people who are giving answers which are not truthful or honest, or they being strategic themselves in how they are giving answers, then the nature of the question that is being asked is also matters, because slight changes in the nature of the question could give you very different nuances in the actual answer. But are there a purpose to the opinion polls? Yes, they are. And they are largely for the political parties, because I think the political parties would want to know where does our support lie? What does it look like? Where is the demographics? In which demographics does our support lie? Where should we focus resources in order to bulk up? Or where should we not even worry about it because our support is so minuscule, going to campaign there just has symbolic value. So it's good in that sense, but it also serves a strategic purpose. If you want to marshal or rally voters, you want to alert them that, hey, look, the people you don't like, they're doing really well. So if you really want if you want to do better and you want to keep those guys out of power, you better come vote for us. Conversely, you want to put out confidence signals to your supporters, your electorate. And lastly, you could want to psych out the opposition and put out, you know, silly numbers. And you psych them out and so I mean, it has strategic value for the parties in a real sense, but it also have manipulative value in sort of changing and influencing public sentiment. So it's in some measures a campaign tool. It's a campaign instrument.
But it can have an impact on people's perceptions.
Absolutely, it does have an impact on people's perceptions. But I mean, I think South African voters are a bit smarter than that, and you'll see that historically they've defied what the opinion polls have largely been saying.
Ibrahim Fakir, let's wrap it up here, and we hoping to chat to you again as the elections draw closer. Ibrahim Fakir, of course, is an election analyst at the Electoral Institute, ISA. And he has observed if that's the word we can use, many elections, you know, since 1994.
Observed and described, yes. as some people might say. Nice to chat to you, Mike.
Yeah.
Thanks for chatting. Thanks very much.
Until next time on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, I'm Mike Siluma.